From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
Good morning and welcome to Veterans Radio back here in Michigan. It's wonderful to be back. I just returned from the East Coast. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I'll be your host today on Veterans Radio. And joining me as my air boss is Bob Gould, 101st Airborne.
You're left, you're right, you're airborne.
Yes, you are.
You're right. You're airborne.
Yes, you are.
Airborne.
My credentials, I guess you could say.
That's all my colleagues out there.
To all your 101st. In fact, I got somebody that I'm going to talk about today was in 101st. My credentials, I guess you could say, is I was formerly a chief warrant officer, rotor head with 195th Assault Helicopter Company in Vietnam, 1969.
Why did they make you warrant officer? I mean, why couldn't you? You know, pilots are majors or... And you guys were warrant officers.
Well,
what was the point of that?
I think there were two reasons for that, Bob. Number one was that they needed a lot of pilots in a hurry. And the second thing is that they didn't want a whole bunch, I guess, of lieutenants running around trying to be commanders and so forth. And so, you know, warrant officers, our only responsibility was the aircraft. And that was it. And the other warrant officers that are in the military have specialties. They're not... I don't normally have some sort of command responsibility.
You know, I never knew all that. That's amazing.
Well, that's what you learn on this show.
That's great stuff. That is. I mean, who knew what a warrant officer was and how it got started? I think you cleared that up.
Okay. Well, good. We've got a really interesting program today talking about going back in time and taking sentimental journeys and so forth. We're going to be talking about the B-24 today. And we're going to be talking with two people. Number one is we're going to be talking with Darren Scorza, who is the son of a B-24 pilot, and he's founded an organization for the 458th Bomb Group during World War II. And the interesting thing about this is that our second guest on our program is an author, and her name is Marilyn Jeffers Walton, and she wrote a book entitled Rhapsody in Junk. Now, that kind of sounds a little bit, that sounds like something I flew also. But her father was a bombardier on a B-24 and had just gotten to England in 1944, shortly after D-Day, and was on, I think, his third or fourth mission and got shot down over Germany.
One of the things I wanted to know, and I asked my guests earlier, and both guests will be answering this, which one? How can you tell the difference between a B-24 and a B-25?
Hmm? Well, I'm sure that they will clarify
that for us.
I
think a B-24 has four engines.
It seems to me that the pictures that I was looking at in Marilyn's book had four engines on it. Those things are huge. I'm anxious to ask Darren about how big they actually were and how big their payloads were and so on. And
right,
so forth.
Right. And I believe it was the B-24 that was made here in Willow Run.
I think so.
Well,
I think so.
Stand by because we will find out.
Right? We will find out. And also we will find out why people liked B-17 pilots, of course, got all of the publicity because they were called, you know, Flying Fortresses instead of Rhapsody in Junk. Rhapsody in Junk is just the name of one airplane. But, yeah, the B-17 seemed to have gotten all the glory, and the B-24s were left out a little bit. But we'll talk more about that as we go along also. And so I am excited to talk with Marilyn, and she's going to talk about how she went back and found the true story of her father's misadventures and adventures as a POW. He was held as a POW in Stalag III, which was made famous in the movie The Great Escape. And I
it
think
was Stalag III Luft.
That's right.
That's right. Luft that's right. Means air in German, I think. Yes.
Probably. Probably it does. So we're going to get to talk to them in a couple of minutes, but there are two things that I want to address this morning before we get to our Welcome Home segment. As I mentioned earlier, I was in New Jersey last week, which is where I'm from originally. Please don't blame me for that. There are a lot of people from New Jersey. But the reason that I went back there was for our annual Christmas visit. But unfortunately, my brother-in-law is a retired policeman from the town of Piscataway. And his partner of 20 years had been killed. And it was really sad affair because he was killed by a family member. And his name was Jerry Mahoney, and I just wanted to say welcome home to Jerry Mahoney because he put his life on the line for 29 years. He was a great person. I had the honor of meeting him occasionally myself, but his funeral was, you know, those of you that have seen policemen and firemen's funerals are amazing, and it's it was an honor to go to his funeral and to see how well-respected he was in that community. So, Jerry, we're all going to miss you.
Hey, here, here. You know, they are our brothers, military brothers. That's the firemen, the brothers and sisters, firemen and police people.
That's true. They put their life on the line every single day.
Serving the country.
And, yeah, they do serve their country, and sometimes they don't get the recognition that they deserve either. The second thing is on a more positive note. Is a good friend of mine that I went through flight school with, was with the 101st Airborne in Vietnam in 1969 as a helicopter pilot. He had, unfortunately had come down with leukemia. His name is Art Morgan. He lives in Mount Zion, Illinois. And Art finally got to go home after his second round of chemo. And he is home with his family and his daughters. And Art, I'm so glad that you're at home. Excuse me. And he's on the list now for a bone marrow transplant, and so all of our prayers will go out to you, Art and Colleen. And, okay, the rest of the Welcome Home, Bob, you're on.
Welcome home each week on Veterans Radio. We welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of their country. Dateline Tulsa. The airport is to give troops a real special welcome. Returning military personnel will be recognized as they arrived at the Tulsa International Airport. Mayor Kathy Taylor and her Veterans Advisory Council are launching Operation Hero Announcement, which will allow service members and their units to be acknowledged on the airport's public address system. The announcement will begin immediately and continue indefinitely. I'd like to see more of that.
Absolutely.
Dateline, Fort Benning, Georgia. Soldiers from C Company, 1st Battalion, 111th Aviation Regiment arrived at Fort Benning, Georgia after a long deployment to Iraq. I did jump school there.
I've been there.
Fort Benning. Oh, yeah. Columbus, Georgia. Great little town. Dateline, Oregon. Tigard, Oregon. Members of the Oregon National Guard, the 41st Brigade Combat Team, returned in recently from a 16-month deployment that included a year in Afghanistan. Dateline, Utah. 300 members of Hill Air Force Base, 388th and 419th Fighter Wings deployed to Iraq have arrived home. Welcome Home is sponsored each week by the Marine Scholars Program of Ave Maria University. For more information regarding the Marine Scholar Program, visit them online at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. That's 239-280-2552. Welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
How many of you are suffering from some kind of chronic pain? If you are, then you're just one of millions of people our age who just live with it. I strongly suggest that you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. The highly qualified and friendly staff at Quantum are the movement experts and are committed to coming up with a specific solution for your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, or age-related morbidity, they can help you lead a productive life.
Quantum Physical Therapy has two locations, one at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti, and the other at 6180 Michigan Avenue in Saline. That's Quantum Physical Therapy. 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 734-483-9200 or on the web at www.qptherapy.com.
One of our planes was missing, 2 hours overdue. One of our planes was missing with all its gallant crew. The radio sets were humming, they waited for a word. Then a voice broke through the humming, and this is what they heard. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a...
Coming in on a wing and a prayer, and that's what we're going to be talking about today, is the B-24, better known as the boxcar. And joining me first on Veterans Radio is, where did he go? Here he is, Darren Skorzeg. Darren, welcome to Veterans Radio. Darren?
Yes, hello.
How are you doing?
Hey, Dale, pretty good.
Good, and welcome, and thanks for coming on to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about, you are the son of a navigator on a B-24, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you don't have to call me sir, I'm a warrant officer.
That's all right, I was a Spec 4 for 4 years. So.
Oh, okay, well, that'll do it. It's kind of ingrained in us. Tell me a little bit about the B-24.
The B-24, actually... The Army asked Consolidated to come up with a second bomber, and they thought they could come up with a better bomber than the B-17, and that was in early 1938. The B-24's first flight was on December 29th, 1939, and that was after about 4 years after the B-17 had been in service.
Now, to answer one of our questions that Bob had, is that how many engines did the B-24 have?
It had 4 engines, and the B-25 had 2.
There you go. You just won your bet. Okay, so the B-24 is kind of an upgraded, bigger version of the B-17. Is that correct?
Not actually larger. It was just a different model. It was a different bomber. The B-24's wingspan was 110 feet, length of 67 feet. And the B-24 could actually carry a larger bomb load and fly longer distances than the B-17.
Mm-hmm.
It was used in all theaters of war, and even the Navy had their version. They used it for photo recon as well as bombing. It was used for patrolling or submarine patrol in Britain and off the Atlantic coast of the States, and Britain even used it quite extensively.
Okay, we got another question. Where was the B-24 built?
There were 5 plants that mainly built. Consolidated had 2 of them, one in San Diego, one in Fort Worth. Douglas Aircraft built or had a plant in Tulsa, Oklahoma. North American had a plant in Dallas, and of course Ford had Willow Run right there where you're at in Michigan.
That's true, just down the road a ways.
Darren, this is Bob Gould.
Bob.
I'm just itching to ask you a ton of questions because my mother worked there. She was Rosie the Riveter.
Oh, really?
Yes, she did. And my aunt did something else, assembling radio, something along that line. So I'm very interested in finding out about Willow Run. Was that the first one that was built, or one of the first ones? I was always told it was because of Henry Ford's genius when it came to putting together assembly methods.
I believe that's true. I'm not exactly sure if it was the first plant out there. I don't believe it was the first plant. It may have been the fourth or the fifth plant that came online, but it was the most productive. And I have read that at the peak of their production, they put out a B-24 bomber every 63 minutes.
Wow.
Which that's quite amazing. And that was due to Henry Ford's assembly line process.
I have one other question because I want this cleared up. I was told that President Roosevelt came to Henry Ford and said, "You got 6 months. Can you do it?" And he said, "I can." Is that true?
I good question. I do not know.
I guess somebody will have to send us an email and let us know if they know the answer.
Oh, I'd like to know that. Six
months. Well, if you can give us a call, too.
He made it out of wood. He made the place out of wood.
I know. Yep. I know. We're talking with Darren Scorza, who is the founder of a website entitled the 458thBG.com, and it's all about the 458th Bomber Group, in which his father was a participant, and also which our other next guest's father was also a participant in there. And I noticed, Darren, that you started this website because you said there was just a lack of information out there about the B-24, and especially about the 458th Bombardment Group.
Well, when I started researching a number of years ago, I was a little disappointed by the lack of information on that bomb group, as opposed to some others. So I started researching and getting records from the National Archives and all over the advent of the Internet. If it hadn't happened, I couldn't be doing half of what I'm doing. But I put the website up in order to, garner more information, and it's really kind of taken off. And I've got so much information now, I'm really far behind on updating the site, which is better than having not enough.
That's true. It's always difficult to keep your website up to date, yep. It seems.
But that bomb group, my dad flew in it in the early days, and I just became, enamored by all the crews and the stories, and it's amazing what those guys did back then.
It truly is amazing, and not to take anything away from the pilots of today and so forth, but these people really were flying planes that sometimes weren't meant to get off the ground, it seemed like. And popping rivets every time they ran down the runway, and a lot of them kind of wore out quickly.
Oh sure.
I also went to found some more information that on the B-24 on a thing called the B-24 Veterans Group. It's an internet B-24, and it said that the there were only two B-24s left in existence, or two flight worthy ones, and I want to think that there was one at Willow Run, but I don't know if there was anymore or not.
One of them is a B-24J, which is operated by the Collins Foundation, and they tour the United States every year, giving rides and letting people, climb aboard and look around. And I was fortunate in 2004 to take a 30-minute flight on that, and it really was, it capped off all my understanding of what my dad went through and what all those guys went through. It was quite the amazing experience.
Well, I think it's an amazing story that you are putting out on the internet for people, and I encourage people to go to the 458thBG.com group to find out more about the B-24, because unfortunately our parents are passing away, and now it seems like it's up to us to continue the tradition going forward of telling their stories.
Right, and that needs to be done. So
Darren, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
You bet.
And you're more than welcome to hang on the line and listen to the rest of the program. Right now, I'm going to bring on our next guest, which is Marilyn Jeffers Walton. Marilyn, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning. Nice to talk with you.
How are you this morning?
I'm just fine, Dale.
Marilyn is the author of Rhapsody and Junk. Rhapsody and Junk is about her father, Lieutenant Jeffers, who was a bombardier on a B-24, and it talks about his adventures going through flight school and going through training and so on and so forth. And talks about his adventures going to England and keeping his diary, and she's got her book is full of pictures of the entire story, and how once he arrived in England, he arrived there in spring of 1944 and ended up only flying three missions, unfortunately. And after those three missions, he was shot down over northern Germany, and the book goes on to tell that story. Marilyn, tell me how you got started on this particular book.
Oh, I had a lot of reasons to write it. I think writing a book about men of such historical significance as those who served in World War II was really very appealing to me. My father was one of those men, and so were the fathers of all people my age. So I think I felt that they needed to be recognized and appreciated. And my father had told me quite a bit about the war and his prisoner of war experiences, and I guess I just needed to know a little bit more.
Well, you initially started this book off as kind of just a family story, wasn't it?
Yes, that's how it began, and it really grew from there. It grew to 500 pages.
Whoa.
And I had to cut it off at that point because, and even now that it's written, more stories come in, and I'm still in contact with the Germans who tell me even more new things that they're finding out, so even as early as last week. So As I went back and forth to Europe, to England and to Germany several times, I began to hear the German side, too, and all the German stories, which were really fascinating to me. So I incorporated some of those stories into the book as well.
Tell me a little bit about your father.
My father was a great man. He didn't have too many missions under his belt before. He was very patriotic, and he joined up after Pearl Harbor, some years after that, to serve his country. And he became a bombardier and went to England, and he only had three missions. I mean, that time in the war, in spring of 44, when he went over, the air war had really intensified when you consider that 72% of the bombing in occupied Europe took place after D-Day. That's when he was there. And the statistic then was one in three crews would probably not make it back. They would either be killed in action or taken prisoner of war. And he had bombed France twice, the V-1 rocket factories on the rocket coast. And then after that, his third mission was into Germany, and that's when he was shot down.
Yeah, the book that we're talking about is titled Rhapsody in Junk, which is just mm-hmm. the name of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Although in reading your description, or actually some of the descriptions in your book about the plane, is that it was kind of a worn-out plane anyhow.
Yeah, it was called one of the war wearies. It already had 67 missions on it, and with all the engine hours, it was probably not in great shape, and that was not unusual during the war. And a lot of those older planes were made into, they were painted polka dot, and they were made into assembly planes. That one probably should have been, and as the formations would spiral up, the formation plane would be easily seen because it had polka dots all over it.
Okay.
It was hard to say. I mean, they encountered flak, intense flak, but their engines started going out. So it was partly due to engine failure that they went down and also the flak damage.
I want to talk a little bit about the B-24 again before we really get into your story. I'm talking with Marilyn Walton, our writer of a relatively new book called Rhapsody in Junk. The B-24 flew at very high altitudes,
mm-hmm.
But it didn't have any heat.
No.
Nor was it pressurized.
No. It was pretty cold up there. Like Darren, I flew on the B-24, and it vibrates, and it's very unfinished on the inside. There's no luxury to it at all. And when I flew it, nobody was shooting at me, and it wasn't 50 below zero like it was for mm-hmm. them. Many of those crews suffered frostbite very badly, and it was the most uncomfortable place to be when you consider how many hours they were on in a mission to Europe. They either flew the northern route over the North Sea, or they flew across the English Channel, but going into Germany especially was a pretty long flight, and once they got to those high altitudes, it was pretty cold.
I would think so. One of the things I liked about the book was that you have excerpts from your father's diary.
Oh, yes.
He's talking about, his missions kept getting scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed,
yeah.
And he felt like, what I go through all this training for.
Very frustrated, yeah.
But that they went up one time, and one of the gunners, I want to say, lost his glove, or
yes.
his electric heating suit didn't work.
Yeah, that was their gunner. His name was Joe Risco, and he had been with them the whole way on the crew, but there was a problem with his electrical suit and his gloves, and he had to take it off, and at that altitude, he was very badly frostbitten, so he didn't make the next mission when they were shot down. So in a way, it was a blessing in disguise for him because it was the very next mission they were shot down. So,
yes.
But that was not unusual. I mean, those things, electrical problems happened with those planes, and frostbite was kind of common.
I would think so. The other thing I wanted to point out is that the crews trained together and came over to England together.
Right, they did. Most of those crews stayed together. Occasionally they would fly, somebody needed a gunner or whatever, they might go with a different crew, and those planes got switched around quite often over there. But they were a pretty tight, close-knit family, the crew, by the time it left the United States and flew together. They were pretty tightly bonded.
I think it's amazing. You can understand why those friendships are so strong still today.
Right, they still are. They still are.
I think that's
yeah.
that's great.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Marilyn Walton, the author of Rhapsody in Junk, and I want you to take us on that third flight of your father's, if you could.
Right. At that point, as the war intensified, those bomber streams got quite large, 800 to 900 planes in mid-1944, excluding the escorts, which they called their little friends, the fighter planes, mm-hmm. went up. And I know he was in a fairly large bomber stream that day that left England. By the end of the war, when they went to Berlin, the bomber streams were a mile wide, fourth of a mile high, and could stretch 90 miles, which meant it took 45 minutes to pass over the target. That was shortly after he got shot down. His bomber stream was probably not quite that big. They flew the northern route. They dropped down over the Frisian Islands into Holland and went across to bomb in Germany. And they got over Hamburg, which had been bombed so many times by that point in the war, and that's where they really started to get into trouble. Their engines, by the time they passed Hamburg, they were down to one engine, and unfortunately they flew over Kiel, which is where all the subpens were, and it was very heavily defended around Kiel by the flak gunners, the big 88 gunners on the ground. And those flak batteries, a lot of times at that point in the war, were manned by 16-year-olds, Hitler youth, but they had pretty accurate aim. And so the flak finally did them in over Kiel, and then the plane turned north and then northwest, and they tried to get to Sweden. They were really hoping, but they couldn't get there on one engine. So they finally, Northrop, their pilot, lowered his wheels, which was a sign of surrender, and the plane flew quite a bit lower. It flew over a home in a small, very farming village called Blick, and the house was built in 1625. I have a picture of it in my book with a big thatched roof, and it was burning very badly at that point and probably almost set that thatched roof on fire. And then the men all bailed out around Capeln, a town called Capeln, and then the bomber crashed in the woods. And I was fortunate enough to go back and find the woman who lived in that 1625 home, and she watched my dad bail out and heard that plane crash that day in the woods near her home.
Wow, we've got about a minute before we're going to take a break. I wanted two things I wanted to just touch on. Number one is that you said that the captain or the pilot, he lowered the landing gear as mm-hmm. an indication that they were going down.
Right, that was kind of an international sign. If your landing gear came down, then you were surrendering to the enemy.
And they weren't supposed to keep shooting at you then?
They weren't supposed to, no. Sometimes when those men bailed out, they were shot out from the ground. My dad's crew was. They would swing back and forth in those parachutes, and people on the ground would shoot at them coming down.
Wow. And the other thing was that the flak actually is a bullet-like thing that goes up and explodes in the air, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's like brown. It looks like brown, puffy smoke, and it looks quite innocent to see it. But the closer it is to you, shrapnel can fly through. The skin of those planes was quite thin, and the shrapnel, I know my dad said a piece went through, and he ducked, and it just barely hit his head.
Wow.
A lot of the men were hit with that shrapnel.
Well, we're going to come back after our next break and talk about what happened on the ground in Germany.
Okay.
You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Lloyd Burke killed more than 100 North Korean soldiers in a one-man assault on their positions. Details after this.
College isn't cheap. In fact, it can be downright expensive. But the Air Force has a way for you to get that college education. If you attend classes while on active duty, we'll pay up to 100% of your tuition. And you could have more than $35,000 for school waiting for you through the GI Bill. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on to airforce.com. This message brought to you by the U.S. Air Force and this station.
Intense enemy fire had pinned down leading elements of his company, committed to secure commanding ground. When Burke left the command post to rally and urged the men to follow him toward three bunkers, impeding the advance. Dashing to an exposed vantage position, he threw several grenades at the bunkers. Then returning for an M1 rifle and adapter, he made a lone assault, wiping out the position and killing the crew. Closing on the center bunker, he lobbed grenades through the opening and with his pistol killed three of its occupants attempting to surround him. Ordering his men forward, he charged the third emplacement, catching several grenades in midair and hurling them back at the enemy. Inspired by his display of valor, his men stormed forward, overran the hostile position, but were again pinned down by increased fire. Securing a light machine gun and three boxes of ammunition, Burke dashed through the impact area to an open knoll, set up his gun, and poured a crippling fire into the ranks of the enemy, killing approximately 75. Although wounded, he ordered more ammunition, reloading and destroying two mortar emplacements and a machine gun position with his accurate fire. Cradling the weapon in his arms, he then led his men forward, killing some 25 more of the retreating enemy and securing the objective. Burke's heroic action and daring exploits inspired his small force of 35 troops.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Pat the Handyman and his team is ready to help you with your remodeling, repair, and painting projects. Call Pat the Handyman at 734-260-1158. That's 260-1158. Pat the Handyman is a veteran-owned business.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313.
Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnicot Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years' experience in boat sales, sail, and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs. Back on Veterans Radio, listening to a little more World War II music, and we're talking with Marilyn Walton, the author of Rhapsody in Junk, who is talking about her father's adventure and experiences as a bombardier on a B-24 in 1944, who was shot down over Germany, and we just got him shot down out of the air, didn't we, Marilyn?
Right. Now and he's landing on the ground.
And then what happened? It got even more interesting.
When I went back, Gretchen Bartel is the woman, the German woman who watched him bail out, and she took me to the field where he came down. And he had talked about that for years when he hit the ground. There was a German farmer there. And he asked the German farmer if he was in Sweden. He really didn't know. And he said, nein, Deutschland, which was bad news for my dad.
Right.
And he was taken for interrogation. Eventually, the rest of the crew was rounded up, and they all went to a castle called Schloss Gottorf, where I visited there. And they were kept down in these kind of dungeon-like cells the first night they were there. And they were interrogated briefly there. And then they went on they were actually there two nights in Germany, and then they went on to near Frankfurt to Oberursel, to Dulagluft, where they were interrogated. It was pretty disheartening for them to know that they weren't going back when they jumped out. A lot of the men say, you know, they see the rest of the bomber stream go on without them when their plane leaves the formation, and it's really very discouraging.
Sure.
So
you can't stop.
No. Yeah, so he was interrogated there. They eventually ended up at Stalag Luz 3, which is now in Poland. I've gone back there to visit to see what remains, and you're correct, that's where the Great Escape took place in March of 1944. They got there in late June of 44, so they had just missed that. But they were there for the big evacuation march that happened later on into January of 45. The Russians had launched their winter offensive January 16th of 45, and by January 25th, the news had arrived that the Spearhead had reached 300 miles across Poland and paused for a short time at the Oder River near Steinau, and that was just 48 miles due east of Sagan, where the camp was. So at January 27th, 4:30 in the afternoon, Hitler had a staff meeting in Berlin and decided to evacuate all those men. And at that point, the Russians had already crossed the Elbe River, and Hitler wanted to get them out of there so the Russians wouldn't liberate that camp because there were so many men there, and he didn't want them to join forces.
Why do you think, in your book, you mentioned that he either wanted them evacuated or shot?
Well, at first he did want a lot of them shot. If push came to shove, he wanted them shot. But he wanted to evacuate them. Some of them, in fact, one of the men on my dad's crew, one of his gunners, was the nephew of the president of Mexico. And anybody who was related to someone fairly popular or well-known in the world was called Prominente. And Hitler had decided at one point to use them to take them further south into Bavaria to use in negotiations when he knew he was losing the war at the end. But that never happened. But the threat always hung over their heads that they would be shot. Instead, they were marched out in the coldest winter in 50 years in that area in Upper Silesia. And they marched for 62 miles and then were put on boxcars and went down to Moosburg, to 7A, the camp down there, where they were finally liberated.
You mentioned that your father had been interrogated. Can you describe his interrogation, or did he ever talk about that?
Yeah, all the downed airmen went to Dulagluft, which is fairly close to Frankfurt, in a town called Oberursel. And once they were taken there, the RAF went there too. The Americans went there. And they normally were put into the cooler, which is no longer there. I've gone back to visit there, a big U-shaped building with very tiny cells. And the heat would be turned up. That's the only thing that all of them that I have talked to have complained about at first. My dad used to say they did that to soften him up. It got unbearably hot in those cells. And if you only gave name, rank, and serial number, they usually let you go within about 3 days, depending what part of the war you were interrogated there. If you gave bits of information, sometimes they would hold you longer, or if you were of particular interest to them for some reason. But my dad was there about, and his crew, they were there about 3 days before they were transferred up to Poland, well, what was Germany then, to Stalingrad III.
So they evacuated all of the pilots and crew members from Stalag Luft 3, and then they moved them down. What happened as the war started to wind down?
Well, the camp that they went to was in Moosburg, Germany, which is near Munich, and they took the boxcars there, which was just horrendous. At that point, they had dysentery. They had marched in the cold with very little food, not enough adequate warm clothing. They had lice, bed bugs. It was just miserable. And by the time they got to the camp, the situation there was really even worse. It was a French camp that was originally meant to hold just 10,000 men, and by the time the war was over, there were 100,000 men there. And food was very inadequate. Sanitation was almost non-existent. And Patton's Third Army came in and liberated them, which was a joyous day. All the prisoners of war that I talked to that were there, including my dad, can hardly describe that feeling of liberation when they saw the American flag go up without getting choked up, even 60 years later.
I can't even imagine that. And your book has got some great pictures.
Yeah, those were taken with clandestine cameras of the flag going up. There were several flags that went up. One went up in the camp itself, and there's a great picture in the book of, you can see the shadows on the fence of those raggedy men saluting. A flag went up at the town in Moosburg at the on the big flagpole there, and then St. Castellus Catholic Church was right outside the barbed wire, and my dad could see those steeples the whole time he was incarcerated there, and some P-51s came in and just shot those Nazi flags off those steeples, and then they put two American flags up there, so it was a pretty happy group. There's a great picture in the book of a tank. You can't even see it's a tank. One of Patton's tanks came in, and the men just jumped all over that tank. And they were kissing the tank, and they were. It was just a completely scene of jubilation for sure.
You can certainly understand that. I'm looking at the picture right now. Inside the book is called Rhapsody in Junk.
Yeah.
A daughter's return to Germany to finish her father's story.
Mm-hmm.
So our father is liberated, thankfully, and eventually gets home safely.
Mm-hmm.
When did he start talking to you about that?
Oh, I think when my sister and I were old enough to really understand anything about the war, he did. But he didn't. Some men don't talk at all about this, I found. he would tell us things from time to time, and after a while, especially as I started doing the book, I started to piece all those things together. Little memories would come out, and it's interesting that the things that he told me, I eventually found what remained for my dad's crew and their families, and we reunited at a prisoner of war reunion, and we were all raised with these same crew members, so we had a lot of similar memories. And the four things that I found in all the prisoners of war that I've interviewed, and there's been hundreds of them now, four things they never forgot. One was the ships floating below them on Normandy as they flew over the beachhead there. Mm-hmm. My dad used to say it looked like matchsticks floating down there as far as the eye could see. The American flag, of course, going up at the flagpole at Stalag Luft, or 7A. And the taste of white bread. They had not had white bread in so long. They had German brown bread, which was very heavy and sour and full of sawdust. And it was an awful thing to eat. And they had lived on that for quite a while. And the other thing, and they've all mentioned this to me, is that when the train taking them down to the next camp stopped, it was their first bathroom break. And it was outside Dresden. And as far as the eye could see, again, thousands of bare-bottomed men squatting in the fields by the boxcars. They never forgot that, and they have all mentioned that to me. And it was kind of a sign of just how far they had come. And I think probably that's why it stuck with them. But universally, they've all mentioned those four things to me. So.
Well, there's a lot of people that can relate, especially to the getting out of the boxcar. In a combat situation, even, you know, somebody's always got to set up a perimeter, those things that, you know, you just can't stop.
Yeah, my dad spent his 24th birthday on that boxcar, which made it even sadder.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness.
Yeah.
So he came home, and did he immediately get involved with the POW associations or groups?
The first meetings were in Dayton, Ohio, and he attended those. And then periodically they would have prisoner of war reunions for Stalag Luft III. What's interesting now is that the families have taken over the next one for any of your listeners who might have been in Stalag Luft III, because the word doesn't get out. There is one at the Millennium Hotel in Cincinnati, Ohio, on April 27th. And anybody who's been in the camp or families of members, even if they're deceased now, we welcome all of them to come to the reunions. And the families are going to try and keep the whole thing going.
Okay, that's at the Millennium Hotel in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cincinnati, Ohio, April 27th.
Well,
and it'll last 3 or 4 days.
I think that should be great. We're coming up on another break here. And then when we get back, I want to talk a little bit about the experiences that you had in going back to Germany and seeing how we can tell that story a little bit. I'm trying not to give your whole book away. So
it's a big book.
Well, we're talking with Marilyn Walton, the author of Rhapsody in Junk. It's a great story about her father's adventures in World War II, of going on only his third mission in a B-24 and getting shot down over northern Germany, ending up in a POW camp, and then he comes home safely. But Marilyn researched this whole thing, and that's what I want to talk about next, is the research. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
Gary Lilly and Associates is now Sperry Van Ness Lilly and Associates, the newest Michigan affiliate of a leader in the commercial real estate industry, Sperry Van Ness. More than 800 Sperry Van Ness advisors in 136 markets sold nearly $11 billion in commercial real estate last year. That was done by putting the client's interest first, thereby generating maximum return for every property. When we list a property, we immediately place it on 6 internet commercial listing services and email it to 40,000 prospective buyers and 60,000 commercial brokers. We offer to split the commission 50-50. That means your interests, not ours, are placed first. To learn more, call Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates Commercial Realtors at 800-345-6694. That's 800-345-6694. Be advised, there is a difference.
Been taking a sentimental journey, and that was Doris Day, for those of you out there who can remember Doris Day. We've been talking with Marilyn Walton, the author of Rhapsody in Junk. It's a great history of her father's adventures during World War II. And how did you get back to Germany and do all this research?
Well, I think like Darren said, without the internet, I couldn't have done it. I began to make contacts in Germany. I think for somebody who wants to do this kind of research, if you can pinpoint where a plane came down, you can write to local newspapers. And I have a very good source in Belgium who gave me the names of newspapers locally that I wrote to ask if anybody living there remembered that day and what happened. And I immediately got a response from several people there. And then I just, through my 15-year-old translator, German translator over there who was translating for his grandfather, we began to find other people, other sites, and do more investigation. My dad lost his top turret gunner. He was found dead on the ground that day, and he was always haunted by that and what happened to that man. So I was able to find old documents, old archives, German documents. The National Archive in Maryland has a lot of documents. So it kind of depends what you're looking for. But one thing builds on another, depending on what I found, I went with that.
Well, it is truly an amazing story. Tell me about some of the things that you found that turned out to be so valuable to your father.
Well, I think the thing you have to start with is the missing aircrew report. And for those of your listeners who may not be aware, you can even get them from the Department of the Air Force. There is an address at Maxwell Air Force Base where you can get missing aircrew reports. All of these planes that went down had reports filed about what happened to the crew. And sometimes, if you're lucky, those reports will have German records in that are translated also, which my father's did. Each missing aircrew report has a number on it. And if you don't know the number of your missing aircrew report, you can get it through armyairforces.com. And there's different ways you can get that number. And once you have that, that's a good starting place right there. If a man was killed on the crew, you can get an individual deceased personnel file, which I got for the gunner of my dad's crew. And, in fact, I even found a handwritten map in there that I took with me to Germany and found the German cemetery where he had been buried, because my father always told us about leaving his body there at that German cemetery. Mm-hmm. Then I was actually able to find the grave and take a picture of it for the family.
What about the teacup or teaspoon?
Oh, the Germans gave me pieces of my... When these planes went down, the salvage crews came in, the German salvage crews, and a lot of times they had Russian prisoners of war working with them who weren't really too anxious about picking up all those pieces. So things got left behind. If a plane came down in the woods, you're more likely to find things. If it came down in a farm field, they've been plowed up for 60-some years, so those pieces tend to disappear. But my father's plane came down in the woods. So just even a week and a half ago, the man who drew the maps for my book went back and found pieces of the plane still. We've gone back several times, and each time you can find plexiglass and whatever, but the pieces that are on the cover of the book, there's aluminum hooks and a tea strainer, and those were made from the aluminum from my father's plane and were given to me by Gretchen Bartel, who watched him bail out. The other piece on the cover is a black rubber patch, which I assumed came off the tire, but I wasn't sure. And when I came, I brought it back to the U.S. with me and went out to Wright Patt Air Force Base, where they actually have a B-24 on display. And put it on the tire of that plane, and that seam matched exactly, so I knew it was off of his plane.
Wow. This is a great story, and I strongly encourage anybody out there, if you get the opportunity, to read this book, Rhapsody in Junk. How would they go about getting one?
Well, there are several ways to do it. For those who don't use computers, you can call 1-888-280-7715. That's the publisher, Author House. Or go to authorhouse.com and just click on bookstore and type the name in. That's the other book, Rhapsody in Junk. Type that in. And also it's on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. I've put a lot of research websites in the book for those who are interested. There's Bombardier websites. There's the World War II Memorial, where anybody who's had a relative in World War II can register that person to pay tribute. And a lot of researchers go to that website when they try and find people, and the best one is the 8th Air Force, www.com-web.com, and researchers from all over the world monitor that, and so many Europeans are trying to help Americans finish their father's stories by providing information. It's really unbelievable. It's phenomenal the number of people in Europe that are doing that, and also the number of people here, children of World War II vets, who are trying to find that information.
I think what we're finding is that the children of the World War II vets are getting to retirement age, and we have a little bit more time.
We have time on our hands.
Now we're saying, oh, this is a great opportunity for me to find out what actually happened.
And it's a great hobby.
I mean, I mentioned to you the other day that by doing this program, I found members of the crew that were on the LST that my father had been on during World War II, and they have an annual reunion, and so this year I'm planning on going to that,
even though
there's only four survivors.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but there are four survivors, but there's about 25, as he said, kids that show up.
Yeah, the kids, we still say kids. And what's interesting, too, is that during the war, the men who flew the B-27 or the B-17s and the B-24s had kind of a rivalry over their planes. You had mentioned that to Darren. And it still exists with the kids. Darren and I are B-24 boys, and we have other research friends who are definitely B-17 boys. So that perpetuates 60 years later. The other thing I've noticed, too, that I think what got a lot of these men through the war was their sense of humor. It really kept them going, and I know on Liberation Day when Patton's Army came in, they immediately set up music, they brought food in and all that, and they kept playing certain songs over and over that were popular at that time. One was Don't Fence Me In, the other was At Last.
I wish I'd known. I would have played those today.
Yeah, and the other, they showed the movie The Thin Man Returns Home, so I found that humorous. And then when they were at Stalag Luft 3, they called the guards goons. Any POW knows that term, goon. And the Germans were very suspicious about that term, didn't know exactly what it meant. So they told them it meant German officer or non-com, and that seemed to pacify them for a while. But it was actually a Popeye character named Alice the Goon, which was just a big, dumb, awful person.
That's true. Yeah, that, the humor. Because when I was looking for the music that I wanted to play for the bumps today, I found Spike Jones and
he was really good.
For those of us our age, we'll remember Spike Jones. They're pure.
Yeah, there's a lot of good music that came out of that era. I still love it, and I think the music got them through, and I think their sense of humor got them through, and their sense of patriotism certainly got them through, and they survived it and came home and led very fulfilling lives afterwards, and they were very humble. The whole generation was very humble in what they did. So,
Marilyn, I want to keep you on for a second because I'm going to do a quick segue here. Mm-hmm. Our next program is on war dogs, and it's our War Dogs 2 show.
Mm-hmm.
And we did one back in August about sentry dogs, and we're going to be talking more about dogs in the military. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to give you another free promo here. The next
perfect
book that's coming out, yes, I know the next book that is coming out or just recently has come out for you is entitled Badge on My Collar, and it's a chronicle of courageous canines. And I believe you dedicated it to...
I dedicated it to not only the police, military, and search and rescue dogs and their handlers, but in the appreciation of 4,000 dogs that went off to Vietnam. And of that number, only 200 war dogs came home, which is a sad statistic.
It's a very sad statistic. We have a good friend who's always talking about how he had to leave his dogs there.
Oh, I've read those,
And it still haunts Vance, doesn't it?
Yeah, there are a lot of websites about that. And hear those stories. They're very sad.
Well, Marilyn, I think it's incredible. You're a great author, and I strongly encourage people to read one or both of these books. They're very interesting. One is entitled Rhapsody in Junk, Daughter's Return to Germany to Finish Her Father's Story. And the second one is The Badge on My Collar, A Chronicle of Courageous Canines. And it's Marilyn Jeffers Walton. Marilyn lives in Ohio, down in Oxford, correct?
Miami University.
Right by Miami. And you can find these books on the website. It's authorhouse.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I would strongly encourage anybody who's got an interest in all these things. Plus, you've written other kinds of books, too.
Six children's books. So this was quite a departure from children's picture books. So I did six of those first, then did the World War II book, and then the canine book.
Wow. Well, Marilyn, I want to thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Dale. It was nice talking with you.
Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, Bob, there you go. You got your answer to your question. on the B-24.
Except did it take 6 months, only 6 months. That would be interesting. Hmm?
6 months?
To build it, to build Willow Run.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I heard, that Roosevelt called Henry Ford into the office and told him, can you do this? Can you do this in 6 months? There was all those fields.
Well, we'll ask our audience out there. If anybody knows the answer to that question, you can send Bob an email at bob@veteransradio.net and answer that question, and you'll get a free Veterans Radio pencil or something that we've got around here.
Sounds good to me. Keepsake.
It is. Next week, I want to remind you again that our program next week is War Dogs 2, and we're going to be talking about sentry dogs and point dogs and how dogs are used in the military. And as you heard Marilyn mention, the idea that so many of them did not come back from Vietnam, and it was very sad for them. I want to make sure that we thank all of our sponsors. Without you, we could not be here. And we really, if anybody's interested in advertising on Veterans Radio, just give us a call. We're more than happy to talk to you. Our sponsors are the Marine Scholars Fund, Quantum Physical Therapy, Legal Help for Veterans, Lynn Pitlack, CPA, Schrader Yachts in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. I got to see Ray over the vacation. He says greetings to all of you veterans out there. Gary Lilly and Associates, Barry Van Est, Commercial Realtors, and our friend Pat the Handyman, who is always out there, and Pat can always help you with anything else that you need. A couple of programs that I know that are coming up in the near future. After War Dogs, we're going to be talking with the author of a new book called These Scars Are Sacred, and it's a story of a Marine who talks about his experiences. So it's a very similar story that I think that you're going to find a lot of Vietnam veterans can relate to, and it's being used quite a bit in VA hospitals around the country. To help veterans, not only of the Vietnam generation, but also of the Iraq generation, to deal with their emotional issues that they all have when they come back. And I think it's in March. We've got a program call coming up about Battlefield Promises. You know, for those of you out there who were getting shot at some time and said, if I get through this, I will serve the Lord the rest of my life. And we're going to be talking with some people who made those battlefield promises and actually kept them. I think that you're going to find that interesting. It's been an interesting morning, Bob. I appreciate you very much for helping me with the board in there.
Standing by.
And we will all be back next week. Until that time, we're going to say you are dismissed.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of our guests and are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.